Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are disappointed in the eclipse and also battling a stomach bug. Anyway, we're your hosts. That's Brie.
And that's Angie. I am disappointed. We had a chance. In fact, I think there were people in Houston that saw it, but at my house, it was like gray, super cloudy and rainy. So we didn't see a dang thing.
But God, that is such a bummer.
I mean, there's people that traveled from all over probably the world, but I know the US, to these different places to go see the eclipse. There was like some town in Arkansas that declared like an emergency situation because they had so many visitors. Like, that is crazy.
Suckers.
And I just kept thinking, like, the only emergency situation is when you have to go to the bathroom and you can't find one because, like, there's long lines at the gas station or whatever. That's when you need to have one of those, like, portable situations.
Well, yeah, that would also be my particular fear at the moment. So I flew back home from Mexico yesterday and brought with me a fun little stomach bug. And it didn't hit me until we were, like, at the airport. And I had dressed in this cute little jumpsuit to travel. And for those who haven't tried to go to the bathroom in a jumpsuit, like, it's a process. You basically have to get naked. You know, you got to take the whole thing off.
I don't wear jumpsuits.
Well, oh, that's one of my God. Why. There were several, like, emergency situations yesterday, right? And I was just like, this was the worst outfit I could have chosen.
I feel like there's certain clothing items, if you wear them, you are just asking for it. It's like white pants. Like, oh, you can't wear white pants or shorts or skirt. There's not a light color anything that goes on the bottom part of my body because I already know. Like, it's going to get dirty. Like, yeah, there's going to be some sort of potty emergency. Like, something bad's going to happen.
Also, just where do you sit? Do you have to wipe down everything you sit on? Yeah.
High heels are another thing for me because I can't walk straight. I broke my ankle walking across the street in flats. So I don't ever wear heels because I'm like, can you imagine what would happen?
I sprained my ankle and shaved a bone off in my heel wearing Birkenstocks. Oh, of all things.
That's pretty bad.
So let's see. We've talked about feet and poop on this episode. Fantastic. What are we actually here to talk about today, Brie?
No. You're not getting away so easy. I want to hear more about this trip to Mexico that you had.
Yes. So I told John when I was pregnant, I told him that whatever I spent on my out-of-pocket costs to have Harper, he had to spend on a trip for us, which felt like a very fair compromise. And so we went to this, like, one of those just all-inclusive resorts in Mexico, and you can upgrade to a room that has, like, a swim-up pool. It was amazing. It was, like, so beautiful and relaxing. And I know we were just talking about this, but I haven't had several consecutive kid-free days in a really long time. And I forgot just how unstressful it is to look after no one's needs but your own.
Like, even women that don't have children, you can easily replace that dependency with work. Like, people are always needing something from you, like, all the time.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just taking a moment to, like, go somewhere where nobody's asking you for work. Nobody's asking you to take them to the bathroom.
We hit the tail end of whale season, and so we got to see a bunch of whales, which was, I freaking love whales. You know, I feel like I could just sit and watch them all day long.
That, you know, I've never seen a whale in real life. Like, there's not whales that hang out in Texas.
I guess that's true. I have been close enough to a whale where it exhaled and all of that fish breath splatter hit me. Don't recommend. It wasn't great. The whales are beautiful, though. But duck when that happens. Wow.
And so where were you when this happened?
Greenland.
Nice.
You know, as one does.
Yeah. Never been to Greenland. Maybe that's my problem. All right. Angie, do you want to introduce our topic today?
Yes, I do. So we are continuing with our EDRM series. And today's episode is about review and analysis. So just to recap, so far in our EDRM series, we have talked about identification, preservation, collection, and processing. And we are now on to today's topic, which is review and analysis. We're going to follow that up with two more episodes to round out the EDRM, and those episodes will be on production and presentation. We are now at this juncture where we've identified the data that we need, we've preserved it, we've collected it, we've processed it, it's loaded up into our review platform. Now what?
That's right. And this part of the EDRM really costs a lot of money. It's usually the part of the process that's the most expensive. When we're talking about review and analysis, we're talking about looking at your data. After we've identified what that data is, we've notified the people that need to preserve it, we've taken measures to preserve data in place. Now we got to figure out what is here. One thing that we may consider is to do something that we call early case assessment. In the early case assessment stage, which is optional, you don't have to do it. If you do have a lot of data, it might be beneficial for you to do it. But what we're generally doing is we're taking a look at your metadata and the content of your documents. Remember, we talked about metadata last time, because those are all the things like the author, the last time that it was edited, what type of file it is. All of those different things are called metadata. And the content is like what your Word document actually contains. When we do the early case assessment, this is also the stage where you might be in some conversations with opposing counsel. And opposing counsel is like, hey, bro, we want like every vague word you ever heard of searched across your entire organization. Like, why don't you do Smith and the number 3, do all these vague search terms so we just get everything you own and we can find something you did wrong, right?
Call that a fishing expedition, folks.
Exactly. This is the part where you go back and forth and you say, look, these are the terms that we think are going to pull back the data that's responsive to whatever this matter is. These are the date ranges that we think are applicable. These are the people that we're looking for. These are all the different ways that they spell their name. Maybe it's Angela, maybe it's Angie, maybe it's Miss A, like whatever. We need to look for all iterations.
Miss A, I'm so sassy.
A. And what happens? Like, what happens when we do run those searches through this data? What is the scope that we're looking at? So early case assessment helps us figure that out, because before we want to pay for reviewers to do the review of this data, or we want to have the time and investment of our own people or ourselves reviewing this data, we want to make sure we cull it down, which is another terminology. When we cull down data, we're making the set of data that we're looking at much smaller. So we're not spending unnecessary time looking at stuff that's not responsive. We're going to talk here a little bit later about software, and that would be a really great time to use software to help us with that early case assessment. Review and analysis. When we are looking at the data, we're also trying to figure out where is the responsive data. It's just kind of like the step we talked about with legal hold. We have to put on hold all the data sources that have responsive information, and it could be a wide variety of different data sources like we talked about. The Internet of Things, it could be databases, it could be loose files, it could be paper, it could be pictures, it could be audio and video content. It could be stuff from O365. It could be spreadsheets, Word documents, emails. It could be chats. It could be a million things, right? That's when we make a decision. Hey, we got to look through all of this data, and we want to do it together as a whole because we want to be as efficient as we possibly can. Once we have those keywords, and once we have the phrases and the people and the timeframes in mind that we're looking for, we want to search once across all of that data. We don't want to handle it all separately. Also, we have to start thinking about building our stories, right? And so the best way for us to do that is take a look at all of the different data sources all at one time. That's what we're going to kind of discuss today. I've already talked a little bit about doing some early case assessment with your keywords, but it's a thing that's going to happen throughout your entire review. We're filtering the data. There's another piece of terminology for you. We're constantly We're constantly putting filters on this data because we want to sift through it and cull it down to only find what is responsible or what's important to help us tell our story, or what is our obligation of all the responsive data that we have to provide to the requesting party. We're also sometimes, when we're talking about analysis and review, we're talking about investigative reviews. And those can be a little different than you're served with a subpoena and you have to produce very matter-of-fact pieces of information. We went all the insurance claims that have to do with this car accident. That's pretty cut and dry.
When you're finding out where the shit is.
Yeah. When you're doing an investigation, it's like, find all the stuff that people are trying to hide that says that they're guilty. That's a little bit different, right? You got some different ways of kind of going about planning out your attack. Angie and I can both attest to the old school way of doing review and analysis, and it's terrible. It can include rat poop or mold in boxes and some storage cabinet. It can include manually scanning documents that you email to yourself, and then you have to figure out how to OCR them, like we talked about that last week time, trying to have searchable text on them. So when you run your keywords, you're actually pulling up documents that have the words on them. Back in the old days, e-discovery was very manual, like the post-it notes that Angie talks about often. And it involved the vendors for e-discovery were very much needed because you would have 50 boxes of documents that you needed to have them TIFF and OCR and provide on a CD or floppy disk or whatever your mode of technology was at the time so that you could load them into a database. And that was progressive. I mean, that was after the manual post-it note stage. Anyway, I don't want to belabor that because we're not talking about the history of review and analysis today. We're talking about what it looks like right now.
Yeah, so we are talking about how we do it today. But I think before we get into the how, like, let's talk about the why. There are a couple of reasons why we review and analyze our data. And first and foremost, like, the court rules make us. You know, you got to play by the rules, got to pay your taxes, you got to review your documents. So the federal rules of civil procedure, which think of them like the traffic laws of this. You know, you leave your house, you have to drive the speed limit. Well, I think speed limits are optional, but that's just me. You have to use your blinkers, whatever. It's sort of the same thing here. That's what the FRCPs are. And they require us to produce relevant, non-privileged documents in a way that's proportional to the needs of the case. First and foremost, we have to find those documents. That's what we've been doing with the identifying, the preserving, the collecting, and the processing. We got to find them. During document review, though, our mission is a little bit more tailored. So during that phase, we're trying to determine what information meets several criteria: relevance, proportionality, non-privileged, etc. So you're just separating the wheat from the chaff during that and uncovering whatever is going to shape your legal battle. That all sounds really, really broad and kind of woolly. So let's talk about a little bit more specifics. Apart from the fact that the court rules make us review docs, we also want to do it because it helps us find information that will either support, refute, or clarify any of the issues, events, or theories in your case. So let's take a lawsuit, for example. You gather a bunch of documents from a bunch of people, and then you got to go through them and figure out, like, okay, say I'm accusing Brie of stealing from me.
Dang, man.
Yeah, girl. Coming in hot today.
I know. So, I'm not stealing your white pants.
Say I'm accusing Brie of stealing my white pants. So I'm going to go through.
So many counts.
that's what I'm trying to review documents to find. Well, I'm going to go through and I'm going to look for any documents, like maybe there are texts of Brie saying, hey, loved the white pants you were wearing. Or maybe there are texts from between Brie and her husband. They're like, hey, I'm going over to Angie's house today. I'm going to rifle through her pants drawer. That's the kind of thing.
So realistic. Angie's pants would fit on one of my feet.
Oh my God, stop it.
And well, by the way, you can invite me and my husband to come over for dinner. Our listeners, we'd be happy to, and we do not rifle through your pants drawers or any other drawers.
The point is, when you're reviewing, you're looking for pieces of information that are going to be helpful to you in some way. And like Brie said, this is very expensive. You know, if you're looking at restaurants and they've got like the $1 sign, the $2 sign, the $3 sign, the $4 sign, review is a $5 sign endeavor. A pretty common estimate is that e-discovery review, that this just the review chunk, is 70 to 80% of the total budget for any given matter. And if we're talking not just percentages, but dollars and cents, you know, this can be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to do your review, just depending on how big your project is. So there are a couple of reasons why review is so expensive. First, your reviewers are paid hourly. They're either going to be contract reviewers or they're going to be your firm lawyers. And if you have law firm lawyers reviewing your documents, which sometimes you just have to do, whether it's the size of the case that you're working on or the subject matter or whatever, sometimes you just have to pay law firm rates. And that's going to run you minimum $400 an hour. And then you have to pay document storage costs. So imagine you're storing terabytes worth of data that your reviewers are trying to go through at $400 an hour. Do the math. It adds up really quick, which leads us back to software and why that is so important. We're going to keep teasing it. We're going to get there in a little bit, listeners, I promise. But okay, so that's the why of doc review. Bree, can you tell us a little bit more about who actually does it?
Yeah. And I hope that as Angie's discussing the why of document review, it's starting to kind of come clear to you why it's so important for us to be very specific about who and where responsive data may be and how important processing is and ESI protocol that we've talked about in our previous episodes. All those exercises that we do to try to limit the amount of data that we're actually reviewing is all in an effort to, number one, save cost, number two, save time.
If you think of it as if it's a funnel, right? At the top of the funnel, you're gathering and collecting your data. And then as you process and whittle down, you're just trying to make it as efficient as possible.
That's right. And knowing that this stage in the game is the most expensive stage, know that there's lots of service providers and software providers in the market today that want to capitalize on this stage of the game. And I'm not saying that it's wrong that they're there to assist for this, because you need assistance from a software. You may possibly need assistance from your outside counsel or a service provider, because this could be an extraordinary effort of data, and it could involve hundreds of reviewers potentially. I mean, depending on what you're working on, you need to take advantage of all of the assistance that's there today. And there's positive, wonderful experiences that you can have with service providers. There's exceptionally amazing software that's out there. But be careful, because this is the part of the e-discovery game that can get tricky. So let's talk about who is doing those document reviews.
Can I jump in just really quick before we move off of the cost? It's actually so expensive to do review that this will often drive the settlement value of any given case. I mean, I think in every single case, that is when I'm assessing settlement value, that is one of my first questions is, okay, how much is it going to cost to get us through discovery? Because it's such a massive part of the budget. You can very quickly assess, like, all right, is this a case that we need to shell out for to get rid of before we get into discovery? Or is it one we're going to be stuck in for the long haul?
Yeah. I mean, that's a fantastic point, Angie. And also that ties right back into that early case assessment. When we're doing the early case assessment,
yes,
we're running through all those keywords. We're trying to make that analysis of like, oh, dog, this is going to cost us $50,000 billion. There's the free math again.
Free math.
Yay, drink. This is going to cost us way too much and we're out. Like, we're settling this bad boy right now. And you're absolutely right. So it's kind of interesting how important that step is or can be. All right. So we were talking about who is doing the document review. Well, generally, it's three different categories of people or groups of people. One is you've got your corporation or your company, right, who is either being sued or they're trying to conduct an investigation or they're trying to fulfill the request of a subpoena. They're somehow, or maybe they've had a cyber breach and they're trying to figure out what data they need to review for the cyber breach. That's another part of review that is kind of e-discovery adjacent and not directly related, but same tools, same concepts a lot of times. So we're talking about companies. It makes sense for companies to do some sort of early case assessment at the very least, but also some part of the review. Why? because companies know their data like nobody knows their data. You, as a company, you know all your quirks, right? You know the dudes that like to save their data on their own desktops, and you know all the different subsidiaries and the ones that refuse to move from on-prem to the cloud. You know the subsidiary that you just bought that has Google. You know all the secret little hiding places that people like to put stuff. You know the proprietary application that you have that you can't get crap out of unless you make them special code, and it's such a pain. You know it. You know Susie, who works in HR, and even though it's not her position, that she knows that she's supposed to be involved in internal investigations, she knows all the scoop, and she's probably texting about it on Teams right now as you're listening to this podcast. You know this because this is
God damn it, Susie.
Dang, Susie. So you know all these things about your company. You know all the ins and outs. It makes sense that you do that precursory look. You're the one that's going to do the early case assessment. You may do a first review pass, which we'll talk about the stages of review here in a moment. But it makes sense that people in a company would do some sort of review. And when we talk about people in a company, it could be your legal department. You've got legal assistants. You've got paralegals. You've got attorneys. You have legal analysts. It could be somebody on your e-discovery or legal ops team, an e-discovery manager, a legal ops manager, a legal ops analyst, anybody in that, in those roles. If you are doing some sort of investigation or a post-cyber breach review, it could involve your data security. It could involve anyone in your IT department. If you're doing some sort of, I have a subpoena that involves a very specific part of my business, or I'm being sued on a very specific part of my business, you're going to go look for the subject matter experts of that part of your business, and they could be doing the review.
Then I love that you put subject matter experts in here, because I feel like they're so often overlooked, but so critical.
Yes. Well, who, I mean, people name, like, if you think about it, every group in a company has like their own weird acronyms and nicknames and like weird ways that they talk about stuff. It's like, I have this recipe that we call crack cookies. What does that mean? We're the only ones that know what that means. Like, other people probably think I'm selling drugs, and maybe I am. It's just in a sugar form. But yeah, crack cookies mean something to me. It might mean something different to somebody else. But in a company, same thing. They know their special little ways of referring to things. They know little quirks about their data. Well, every single time we run a report, it's titled this or that. And so if we're looking for a certain report, this is the file name we need to be looking for. Who knows that except for the person that's in that department working with those reports? So it's really important that companies own up to what they know best. It's the most cost-effective and accurate way, in my opinion, of reviewing data. Obviously, I feel very passionately about this.
No, you're right. I mean, imagine, I can't even tell you how many times I've had to go to an engineer and be like, what am I looking at? Can you help me? Can you look at this? I don't understand, because I don't understand. I'm not an engineer, but they are. And they can tell you exactly what you're looking at in language that you understand.
Oh, yeah. Well, in an investigation scenario, I'm looking at the image of somebody's computer, and I see on their temp file or in their temp folder that they have like $XYZPDQ. What is that? Oh, well, that's what happens when they run a report out of Salesforce and then they try to purge it. What the hell? They shouldn't be running reports out of Salesforce. So yeah, I mean, it's like that kind of stuff that only if you collaborate internally that you're going to know. You're not going to hire some third-party reviewer or a law firm that's going to be like, I know exactly what a temp file in your organization looks like when somebody runs a report that they're not supposed to, and then they try to purge it. They're not going to know.
And that is an unfair thing to ask your outside lawyers to know.
Oh, my God. It might almost be fair to ask an outside forensics expert, but you're going to pay a pretty penny to get yourself there. And especially since the lawyers are usually driving that investigation, it's going to take you a minute to get there if you do. So speaking of that, we have contract or outside reviewers, okay? So these can happen in a couple of different ways. One, let's say we have a large litigation. Everybody's being sued in your company for whatever. Or maybe you have like a patent infringement, whatever. And it involves just loads and loads.
These are the legal terms, folks.
Oh, yeah. So contract reviewers, these are people that are outside of your organization that are going to help you. What you are trying to achieve really depends on the type of reviewer that you need. So in the example of, hey, we need to know everything that happened with Angie's laptop because we think she stole from us. And I don't even mean her white pants. I think she stole stuff that's really valuable.
I think she stole my blue pants.
That's right. It's probably the red ones. So we need to see when her USB drive was in her device. We need to see what kind of, you know, link files she has. We need to see shell bags. Like, we need to see all these things on her computer that will give us just the remnants of data that we can put together to make some sort of assumption of what her motivations were. Let me see. When she performed whatever
snake.
Those actions were. You need some help to do that. That's a very specialized forensic review or investigation. So that would be somebody that you would hire outside of your company to help you with, unless you have a very sophisticated like data security or forensics department within your company. But most people would hire that outside. By the way, when you are hiring people outside of your company, remember, they are likely to be the ones to testify in court about whatever they find. So make sure you don't hire Bubba down the street who has a mullet and wears dirty white pants.
Don't hire anyone who wears white pants. They can't be trusted.
Oh my God. Especially after Labor Day.
God, who made up that rule?
I don't know. My mom's generation. Also, contract reviewers can be in the form of attorneys and paralegals that you hire from either a service provider or that are part of your law firm that you've hired to help you litigate whatever matter that you're working on. And those different companies that offer those services are going to charge you by hour or charge you by size. And they're going to want to know things from you like, hey, do you need all attorneys to do your review? Is it okay if we have paralegals do your review? What is your budget? So let's talk about breach review. When you have a cyber attack in your organization, you're going to
cyber snuck. Whatever data was cyber snuck.
You're going to have to do a review of all the data that was involved in this breach, right? And you're going to have to identify who it belonged to, whose personal information was there, and where they are, because that's going to dictate the next steps that you're going to make in terms of, do you notify, hey, Angie, guess what? You're part of a data breach, blah, blah, blah. Now, this subject, by the way, is a little bit controversial. And if there's true e-discovery people, they're probably like, dude, what trail are you going down right now? That's not e-discovery. That's data governance and privacy and blah, blah. Whatever.
Get off your high horse.
You're going to use a lot of the same tools for this, folks. If you're smart, I mean, if you're not, then okay, you do your thing. But another thing that you might include in a document review could even be like a private eye. You might have to have somebody look at, okay, Angie has this side gig, and I don't mean the eDiscovery Chicks podcast. I mean, she's into something super sus. She has all these websites. She's created this different name for herself. We need a private investigator to look into this and do a review and document all the ways that Angie is doing these super sus things on her own because it is really interfering with her work. So another group of people that may be heavily involved in your document review or your data review is law firms. Of course, you are using them to represent your company. You within the law firm, you have typically your younger associates that are just graduated from law school.
The babies.
The little baby attorneys. They're going to be the ones that are doing that document review. Also, paralegals are heavily involved with document review. It's kind of like a rite of passage, I guess.
Yes, it is.
Is how that works. Yeah.
who does what of all those people and when depends on a number of things. So it can depend on the stage of your review. Oftentimes, like Brie mentioned earlier, companies will do like a first pass review in-house. That's like super broad strokes. Just is it responsive or is it trash, basically? And a lot of times like that doesn't take very long. You can just run some search terms. It's no big deal. So you'll just do it in-house really quick and probably save yourself a significant chunk of change. You can also save some dough by hiring those contract reviewers. Like I said, the little baby lawyers, even the little ones, are going to cost you probably a minimum $400 an hour, depending on like where you are in the country and the subject matter of your case, etc. So, and here's the thing, I meant to mention this earlier, but it slipped my mind. This is sort of kind of the ugly underbelly of the legal system in a way, because review is so expensive, even if you use contract reviewers, that you can sue somebody and your lawsuit could be meritless, you know, just garbage. But this is so expensive that companies will often settle just because it is cheaper to just pay mm-hmm. somebody whatever they want for their quick cash grab than it is to go through this whole process. There are whole cottage industries devoted to this that have
it's crazy.
Like, people just crawl your website and find issues with it and then just serve you a demand letter and say, you know, we'll just copy and paste a lawsuit and companies will just pay up to make it go away. So it's So who does review and when and how much it's going to cost also depends on the size of your project. If you have a small review project, say, I don't know, less than 2,000 documents, less than 5,000 documents, maybe, probably in-house and your firm lawyers are going to divvy that up between the two of them. It's just not worth it to go and train a whole contract review team for a size of documents, for a tranche of documents that's that small. But for bigger projects, you know, maybe you've got a couple hundred thousand documents. Maybe you've got a million documents. Who knows? That you will almost never see in-house lawyers doing that review. In-house lawyers, they're on teams that are pretty lean. They're usually under-resourced for that kind of project. And it's just not the highest and best use of their time. Same with the law firm lawyers. Caveats for the subject matter of the lawsuit or whatever the project is. It's often just not going to be the highest and best use of the law firm's time or the company's money to pay the law firm to have them do that kind of review. At least the first couple passes when you're still really whittling out all the junk and the crap and the things you don't really need. For those bigger projects and those stages, you're going to see contract reviewers. Those guys are going to charge $40 to $100 an hour, you know, a fraction of what you're paying your law firm. And so that's often when you're going to leverage those contract reviewers. That's when you're going to get the most bang for your buck on them. You might also have a specialized level of review. You know, we talked about subject matter experts like engineers and things like that. Those subject matter experts might play a really big role in review if you're on a patent case or something that's really code heavy or code intensive. But you might also have a slate of reviewers that are just doing quality control, right? They're just going through the documents that have already been reviewed and checking that they meet the coding standards for whatever that review project is. That's the who. Let's go to the how.
Me and Angie keep teasing you about eDiscovery software. We assume if you are doing any kind of substantial review that you are taking advantage of some sort of eDiscovery software. Why do we make that assumption? Because number one, we make the assumption that you're not doing a manual review of paper and using post-it notes like we used to back in the olden days. And we also assume that you are working on some sort of litigation where it's necessary for you to have to do things through processing like we talked about in the last few episodes. Like deduping, taking out the duplicates, taking out the different types of files maybe that we don't really care about that are those like machine generated files, like denisting. We assume that you want to take advantage of technology that allows you to label documents or to make notes while you're reviewing, that sort of thing. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Here we go. We're teasing you again. We're going to talk more about software here in a moment when we talk about workflows. But before we start that, let's talk about diving into review and what the initial steps should look like. Number one, you want to have a meet and confer. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Jargon.
So a meet and confer means we're getting the gang together and we're figuring out what the hell. What are we doing here? What are we trying to accomplish? Who's involved? Hey, we've got this internal investigation. We need to figure out who all the parties are that are involved, who we think that they're talking to, how we think they're corresponding with one another, where we could prove that, how we could prove that. We want to figure out what their personalities are, what's a normal thing for them to do, what's an abnormal thing for them to do. We want to figure out all the stuff, right? Because we got to go through their data and try to make a decision whether or not there's foul play. But then on the other hand, we could have a subpoena. Hey, Ms. Murphy, we need to have all of the documents that you have in your possession and control that have to deal with your dental plan. That's pretty dang easy. I know exactly where my dental plan documents are. Super fast for me to find them, super fast for me to load them up for review and produce them. That's like a no-brainer, right? So meet and confer is where we start trying to analyze, well, what is this project going to take? Is it a simple, you know, subpoena, or are we going to have to like pull back everything in the entire organization to figure out what this foul play is that's taking place? With litigation, we oftentimes are looking for not only keywords and date fields and all the ways that we're culling data, right? We're looking for motive. We're looking for intent. We're looking for the story to tell the jury so they rule for us in the end, right? And that is the part of review and analysis that I think adds that human equation that's complicated, right? And it's the part of the equation that requires a lot of communication. And I cannot stress enough that meet and confer is not a one-time event. Meet and confer happens at the very beginning because you're trying to figure out, hey, gang, why are we all here? What are we doing today? But you're going to have those times to talk with each other throughout your entire project. And you should be constantly communicating with your examiners, with your forensic professionals, with your paralegals, with your legal assistants, with your outside review party, your attorneys, whoever is touching data and whoever's looking at it. You need to be in constant communication because somebody seeing a phone that has records on it and text to Bob, and they don't really understand who Bob is and why the text about the printer in the back room is important because they didn't talk to the reviewer that's looking at all the things that were printed off the back room printer that that are super sus. And they need to put this together to figure out how it comes together as a story. So I think that that's something that I just can't say enough of is how important that communication is. Another thing that's important in telling that story is coming up with something like a timeline. What happened when and what happened on this day when all the events went down? What emails were exchanged? What letters were exchanged? What conversations were happening on people's phones? Putting all that information together and coming up with a story and a timeline is really important. Okay, so meet and confer strategy in terms of DSARs. This is another one of those adjacent to e-discovery areas that could typically be done by compliance or privacy personnel. But you're using the same type of technology as e-discovery. And a lot of times e-discovery groups get involved internally in a DSAR. Because you're having to find, you know, Angie's name that was used anytime in any place.
Yeah, should we define DSAR?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea, Angie. I didn't even think about that. So DSAR is a data subject access request. So that is something that happens a lot of times because in either countries like the UK or states like California or other states that have passed this legislation, there is an allowance for an employee to make a request of a company that says, hey, you have the right to see every single time that your name comes up in any type of internal communication or documentation. So in a DSAR, in a data subject access request, An employee, either past or present, can say, I want a copy of all of the data that you have with my name on it. And that is a nightmare for e-discovery, because if you have a name that's very common, like John Smith, then you come up in a lot of places. And then that turns into an enormous review.
Okay.
So we've been talking a lot about meet and confer, trying to figure out what our strategy is and the different types of conversations that you're having based on the type of request or event that you are reviewing data in regards to. All of those add up to the final question that you have to ask yourself, which is, how much horsepower do we need to get the job done? And who do we need to have involved? And what kind of workflow are we going to follow?
So yeah, so this is a super key part of Doc Review. You got to define your workflow. So typically you're going to have, especially on a bigger project, little projects, you might not even need this much horsepower. But for anything sort of 1,000 documents or more, you're probably going to want a protocol. Doc Review protocol is going to memorialize the way that you're going to run your project. And they are super important because you're very rarely going to have only one person doing the doc review. And so you want to make sure everyone is on the same page and operating consistently as you work your way through all these documents. A couple things are going to want in your doc review protocol. Number one, anything noteworthy from your ESI protocol. And I promise you, we will have an entire episode on ESI protocols later in the season. If there are specific keywords you're supposed to search for, if there's a specific order, if specific things are or are not supposed to be tagged confidential, anything noteworthy from the ESI protocol should be memorialized in your doc review protocol so that everybody who touches the project can get up to speed and be consistent. One of the things we talk about a lot when we talk about doc review are tags. These are basically just little labels that you attach to a document that specifies something about that document. They are specific to the case. There is no universal set of tags. There is no one-size-fits-all approach. There are a few things that you'll see consistent from project to project. One of those is privilege tags. On any project, you're going to want to tag any document that is protected by a privilege. What privilege might be applicable to your case? That depends on your case. Could just be attorney-client. Could be work product. There could be a joint defense privilege. There could be executive privilege. So privilege tags are pretty consistent. You're often going to have responsive or not responsive. That's just your first pass review. Is it junk or is it something that we actually want to look at? And then you're going to have palette or two or several of issue tags. And issue tags they can be anything. Like, the world is your oyster. You could have tags that are specific to requests for production. You could have issue specific tags. You could have tags that relate to whether it's hot or not. And hot docs are a specific kind of tag. That's like, is it an important document? Is it important good, important bad, important we don't know? Tags are anything you want them to be. But the key here, regardless of what you put in your coding palettes, regardless of the tags that you create for this project, you want your reviewers to use them consistently. A couple other things you're going to see when you are doing your doc review. You're going to see a notes field usually in your doc review software. And that's just, you can tag something or you can just write a little note to yourself. You know, maybe I've tagged something as responsive to Brie, but it's sort of not clear why. Maybe it's a different family member. You know, maybe it's the attachment to that email that makes me think Brie might know something about this document. And that's why I've tagged it for Brie. So that's one way you can use notes. One other thing I do want to strongly recommend is having regular syncs with your review team, especially on bigger projects. You want to ensure that everyone is aligned. You want to talk about common issues. You want to revisit any baseline assumptions that you've made to make sure that those still hold true throughout your project. You just want to make sure that everybody's rowing in the same direction. Another key thing, a centralized question and answer area, whether that's a spreadsheet or a Google Doc, or you're all just emailing the same person who sends out a report, doesn't matter what it is. Point is, people are going to have questions during doc review. You're going to want to memorialize those somewhere, because if one person has that question, chances are someone else will too. And so you want to create a resource for your reviewers to go to. And the whole point of this, again, is just ensure consistency among your reviewers. Another thing that you may want to do is set expectations about speed. I've worked on review projects where the expectation was a doc a minute. I've also worked on review projects where the expectation was a doc every 30 seconds. I've also worked on review projects where the expectation was a doc every 3 minutes. Depends on what you're looking at. The 3 minute one, I think we were primarily looking at big, long contracts and stuff like that. And so that's why that time frame was expanded. So the expectations are not static. They can be elastic. You might get into your review and realize it's actually more complicated than you thought it was when you started. So maybe you want to ratchet up the amount of time you're spending on each doc. Maybe you're getting a lot during your quality control, you're getting a lot of errors. And so you want to change your expectations for your reviewers and have them spend a little bit more time. One other thing that's critical is a 502D order or a clawback agreement. They can basically do the same thing. It is a way to ensure that if you accidentally produce a document that is protected by a privilege, you have a way to get it back. And so it doesn't become part of the litigation. Can you really unring that bell? I don't know. But at least your data isn't floating around out there in the ether.
Mm-hmm. And can't be used in court against you.
Exactly. So review also happens in stages. So we've talked a little bit about the first pass review. That's just, is it responsive or is it junk? Do we even want to deal with this? Privilege review. This is super, super important. This is where you decide whether you're going to produce your documents, or you're going to withhold them, or you're going to redact them. Privilege comes in a number of forms. It comes in attorney-client privilege. That's most communications between a lawyer and their client are going to be protected by that privilege. There's also work product. So if you're involved in a lawsuit or a legal matter, you're working with a lawyer, the work product that that lawyer creates is going to most likely be protected by that privilege. And if your lawyer asks you to do something, that is also most likely protected by work product privilege. There are a whole host of other privileges out there. And point being, you're going to want to review your documents to make sure that you are doing right by the privileges that apply to your case. After your privilege review, you're probably going to review the text of the document. That can be, you know, the words, the metadata, any pictures or audio, things like that. And then you're going to redact out anything that doesn't need to be produced. Either it's confidential, it's privileged, or, you know, it's just not relevant to the case. That one's tricky and kind of more uncommon, but sometimes you'll see it.
I feel like we've kind of been teasing you guys like all evening with the use of e-discovery software. So let's dig into it, shall we?
Let's.
So when we talk about e-discovery software, we can utilize it to do a wide variety of different services for us, to help our lives be more efficient, to help our companies save more money, to help us comply with our ESI protocol. So it's important that we have a great e-discovery software as a tool that we use. When you're talking about software, educate yourself. Your software provider should be providing training for you. And I really have liked, by the way, having like training libraries available to me. Your document reviews can be just a whole host of different subject matter. And having a e-discovery software that's flexible enough to go whatever direction you need is important. One thing that you want to do is make sure that your e-discovery software has coding panes that you can customize. Just like Angie was talking about earlier, we want to label our documents with labels that are specific to whatever the matter is that we're reviewing. When you are creating coding panes, by the way, you want to make sure that you have that crap on lockdown. You do not want to allow everybody on your team to manipulate your coding pane. Otherwise, you will end up with 50,000 ways of coding the same piece of information, and it will be a nightmare just trying to decipher. Well, when I coded police, I meant the police. When Angie coded Popo, she also meant the police. And when
or the color purple, because that's how my daughter pronounces it.
Yeah, the color purple. And I don't mean the movie, but the color, the actual.
But maybe you do. And that's why you need a document review protocol.
Review batches. These are things that we do to organize our documents to make sure that we're not double teaming on the same document. We're not overlapping our work. I don't want Angie to be reviewing the same documents I'm reviewing because then we're just wasting time. let's batch our documents. So Angie's clear on the 1,000 pages she's got to review, and I'm clear on the 1,000 pages I got to review. We can get this crap done. E-discovery software allows us to do things too, like filtering and searching. We can do that across all of our data types all at one time, which is an amazing accomplishment, except especially if you're around in the olden days, like some of us on this podcast were. When we are looking at documents and searching across the metadata, we can say things like, hey, I want all the documents that were emailed out on May the 5th, because I know that some shenanigans went down that day and I want to see what's up. Or maybe I want to, you know, search the metadata and look for all the PDF documents that belong to Angie. We can run keywords through the content of our data, like I love white pants. That could be a phrase that we run through our data. So that's what we do when we're searching using filters and we're tagging documents that are responsive. Now, we also want to be able to report on those tags in several different ways. For example, one thing that we're always going to want to do, just like Angie was referring to earlier, when we have a privilege review, like when we're looking for documents that actually fit into that privilege category, the attorney and his client or her client are talking about the legal matter at hand. That's privilege, right? So when we label that document privilege, we want our software to be smart and start creating a privilege log for us. We don't want to have to do that ourselves. So that's another thing that's important for our e-discovery software to do. We also want to run reporting like, hey, I have all these people on my team that are reviewing documents. It would sure be nice to know how many documents hit on that I love white pants search. That's important for me to know, because if it's 5,000, this might take a minute. This is going to be real expensive. And maybe we need to like change our strategy or settle right now, you know, because it's just ridiculous. We want to be able to take some stats. We want to analyze our labeling efforts, and e-discovery software helps us to do that. Another thing we might want to do is take out stuff that we can't produce to the other side. I can't produce Angie's address. I mean, I can produce the fact that I went over for dinner.
You better not.
But I can't give her address away. Then everybody else will come steal her white pants. So we want to make sure that we're redacting personal information, right? We don't want anybody to know her birthday, because then there may be a little gift her white pants. But we want to take out social security numbers and credit card numbers and birthdays and things like that we definitely don't want to produce. We also want to take out that confidential information, right? So we want the ability to redact, and e-discovery software allows us to do that by typically creating a blackout box, or sometimes it's white, but really most of the time it's a blackout box. And it's super nice when our e-discovery software can allow us to create a reason for that redaction, because we're going to have to keep tabs of what was redacted and why. Also, when we talk about e-discovery software, there's a lot of things that it can do for us if we have those large document reviews that we're talking about, like terabytes of data, or we're talking about, you know, the internal investigation that we have to search across everybody's email for. We've got a lot of data that we're looking at. We want to be able to utilize our e-discovery software to do AI, which is a hot topic of today, and I'm sure something that we will cover later in the season. And or TAR is the Texas way of saying tire. TAR.
I've never thought about that. That's
every
incredible.
Every time I hear TAR, I'm like, is it a TAR far? But when we talk about TAR in e-discovery world, what we're really talking about is technology assisted review. AI and TAR.
The future.
They get talked about together. They can mean several different things to different people depending on who they are and what the purpose is. But essentially, we're looking at e-discovery technology taking note and learning from our behaviors. If every single time I see the word white pants and Angie, and I'm labeling it Angie's white pants, then our software can be learning from my behavior, from my actions, and it starts creating suggestions for me. Hey, did you see this document? What about that document? What about this email over here? I think these are all about Angie's white pants. Or maybe all of the information that has to do with Bree's name becomes privileged. It's labeled privileged. So anytime that Bree is found on any kind of document or email or text message or whatever, it's a privileged label. Our smart labeling that's available in some e-discovery software will help us by suggesting labels that will say privileged because it's fitting the same criteria. It's learning from our actions of how we are labeling our documents. We can also look for things like concept clustering. It's learning, the machines are learning all of the different ideas, thoughts, phrases, words that are being talked about most often and clustering them together. This is really helpful when we're looking, when we're doing some sort of investigation and we don't know what we're looking for. We're looking for things that look suspicious, but we don't even know what that is. When we start seeing concept clusters of ideas that don't go together, that's weird. Why does this say party, Bree, her husband, and white pants all together and they're being talked about often? Obviously, something is wrong here with some white pants. Whatever the concept cluster is helps guide us to understand the story that the data is telling us. Because remember, beyond the keywords and beyond the metadata that we're searching for and that we're filtering on, we're trying to find the story. We're trying to find the motive. We're trying to find the intent. We also have some capability that eDiscovery software provides us to help, you know, tell that story by putting together insights of who's having the conversations with whom most often. Well, that's weird. I see that Angie's talking to Bob like 50,000 million times a day. And Bob...
Sorry, he also has white pants. I needed to talk to somebody about it.
Bob is part of the White Pants Society. And it looks like there's a conspiracy here. Who knew it? When you are doing analysis and review, it is so important to invest in eDiscovery software to help you with that. Help you do things like remove the duplicates, remove all the things that are not important to the scope of what you're looking for. Have tools that will help automate the different workflows that you have going on. That will help you automatically batch things. For example, like, hey, this tool allows us to prescribe a workflow for how we're doing this review. And every time we ingest data that has to do with Angie's wardrobe, then it needs to be added to some batches and assigned out for review. We have eDiscovery software that will do that automatically for you, helping you to organize and to coordinate with your team, taking notes on documents, coordinating on your coding panels, coordinating by assigning out batches. Those are all ways that our software can help us work together effectively as a team to get the review done the fastest way possible and the cheapest way possible. Using eDiscovery software to help you remove extraneous data that you don't even need to be bothered with. A lot of times, you know, companies will waste a lot of money because they will skip some of the steps that the eDiscovery software makes possible, like early case assessment or deduping or filtering out data, and they'll just send all their data outside to an outside team who will charge them five times as much to review all that data unnecessarily. eDiscovery software is going to pay for itself in terms of the amount of time that it saves, the amount of space that is unnecessary to store your data, and by allowing you to collaborate with your internal subject matter experts, with your internal legal team and your outside legal team and your outside review parties. So it's a collaboration tool. It helps you organize your workflow. It helps you manipulate your data. And by the way, eDiscovery software will be auditing everything that you do so that you have a defensible process. Angie, I feel like we've done a whole entire document review in just this conversation. There's so much to it. And I feel like we just barely scratched the surface.
I know. But I think in terms of just like keeping our listeners, I think we're going to cut it here today, folks. Let's wrap things up. That's all we've got for you today. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to follow us on our socials. You can find us on LinkedIn at eDiscoveryChicks. You can also email us. The email address is admin@ediscoverychicks.com.